Welcome to the Shiur in Sfarno, Parashat Shmos. The Shiur this evening is sponsored by Joel and Elke Hershkovitz, marking the yardside tonight of his father, Moshe Ephraim, Reb Aryeh. Shom Shalav and Aliyah, Shitzi Moshe Nachas, Urach, Natarmis, Sosamai, Sun Tovim, the entire family is involved in. It's also sponsored by Amy Shevlin, marking the yardside tonight of her father, Sam Steinberg, the Chemer Ben Chaim Zev. The entire family is involved in, as well as Judy Levine, marking the recent yard side of her mother, Mary Levine. The Shama again should have an Aliyah, the entire family is involved in. I wanted to share tonight a few unconnected insights from the Sfarno and Parsha Shmos. Yeah, they're not connected to one another, but each of them represents an interesting and, I think in most cases, somewhat unique approach to the various psukim that the Sfarno is dealing with. The end of Perek Gimel is devoted to describing how the Ribbono Shel Olam appears to Moshe Rabbeinu at the Sneh, the burning bush. We spoke about the Sfarno's take on the Sneh yesterday, and he's basically deputizing, as it were, Moshe Rabbeinu to go and carry out the mission of speaking to Paro and ultimately bringing the Jews out of Mitzrayim. So, at the very end of Perek Gimel, Pasuk Chof Aleph, Kodesh Baruch Hu tells Moshe Rabbeinu, V'nosati eschein ha'am hazeh be'enei Mitzrayim, I will cause this nation, the Jewish nation, to find favor in the eyes of the Egyptians. And therefore, when you leave Mitzrayim, you're not going to leave empty-handed. What's going to be? V'sho'alo, isho mishchento, umigoras beso, klei chesef, uchlei zohov, usmolos. So each woman will be sho'el from her neighbor, silver and golden vessels, as well as clothing. You'll take these items from the Egyptians, you'll place them on your sons and your daughters, and you'll empty out Egypt. The translation of v'sho'ala, that each woman will be sho'el from her neighbor, is open to discussion and debate among the Rishonim. Again, as we'll see in just a few moments. Art Scroll translates as follows. Each woman shall request from her neighbor and from the one who lives in her house silver vessels, golden vessels, and garments. Well, there's the translation which the Art Scroll is working with is that the word v'sho'ala, to be sho'el, is related to the word to ask a question. So in other words, each one will go over to her neighbor and ask, could I have this golden vessel, this silver vessel, whatever it happens to be? The vast majority of Rishonim, however, understand that the word v'sho'ala does not mean to ask or to request, but to borrow. We know that in Lashon Kodesh, the term to be sho'el can have both interpretations. It can mean to ask a question, but when you're talking about being sho'el an object, typically it means not to ask for the object, but it means to borrow the object. And if indeed we translate the word v'sho'ala as each woman will borrow, we then find ourselves in a difficult, with a little bit of a difficult, call it a difficult moral question. The Jews are not borrowing these vessels from the Egyptians. They're keeping these vessels that they're taking from the Egyptians. You know, it's kind of like you go over to somebody, you ask them, you know, would you mind if I borrow a tissue? You don't want to borrow a tissue. Certainly, nobody wants the tissue back after you borrowed the tissue. Please keep the tissue, right? So, you know, when the Jews are going to their Egyptian neighbors right before they leave Mitzrayim, and they're saying, as per the simple translation of the Pasuk, can I borrow this golden candelabra, can I borrow these silver candlesticks? The Jews know that they're not borrowing them. I mean, and they have no intention of giving them back. They're leaving Mitzrayim. When exactly are they going to give them back? Right? How active was Amazon in those days? You know, they'll just put it in a box and ship it back to Mitzrayim. What do you mean they're going to borrow it? V'lakcha, they're going to take. So what's v'sho'ala? It seems a little deceitful. If indeed it's translated as the women will borrow from their neighbors and they represent themselves as borrowers, so isn't that deceitful on a certain level? So many of the Rishonim deal with this question. Let's take a look at the Sfarno's take. Sfarno says as follows in Pasuk Chof Beis. Indeed, says the Sfarno, the translation of the word v'sho'ala means to borrow, not to ask, not to make a request. It's not the way Arskol translates it. But rather, each woman shall borrow from her neighbor. And really, since they're borrowing, v'tiyu chayovim la'achzir, strictly speaking, the Jews are obligated to return these objects to their Egyptian neighbors. If you borrow, you're not taking. It's not the same thing as taking. So you really have to give it back. However, hinei tiknu achar kach es hakol bedin. Even though the Jews ended up keeping all of these items and they did not return them, they subsequently were able to keep them. How so? Biradfam achareichem lihilochem lochem. When the Egyptians pursued the Jewish people, as they did, and they sought to wage war against the Jewish people, the intention of the Egyptians was that if they had captured the Jewish people, they would have taken their spoils, just like any spoils of war. What would have happened, let's say, had Kriyas Yamsuf not happened? Had the Egyptians caught up to the Jews at Yamsuf and conquered them and brought them back to Mitzrayim? So all of these golden and silver vessels, in addition to anything that was owned straight away by the Jewish people, would have been taken captive by the Egyptians, the same way that the Jewish people themselves were taken captive by the Egyptians. Ki omnom kasher mesu ba'osa hamilchama, ki Hashem nilcham. However, we know, of course, the Egyptians were not successful in waging war against the Jewish people. They were killed off in that battle. Kodesh Baruch Hu fought the fight of the Jewish people, and the Egyptians all drowned. Hoya b'din mido keneged mido, kol shlal horodfim lanirdofim, keminog b'chol melchama. At that point, the rules of war dictate that to the victor go the spoils. The Egyptians sought to wage war against the Jewish people. They lost. So all of their possessions, at that point, by the laws of war, then go to the Jewish people. We find Chazal tell us that there was a tremendous amount of property that the Egyptians who drowned at Yam Suf left behind, that the Jews came and became rich from taking the spoils which were left at Yam Suf. They were entitled to that by the rules of war. There had been a war waged against the Jewish people, and the Egyptians had lost. And part of losing is that you lose the spoils that come with war. Part of what the Jews gained was the vessels which they had borrowed from the Egyptians. Because, in other words, part of the spoils of war is not just the possessions of those specific soldiers who were running after the Jewish people and seeking to harm them, but as the soldiers represent the nation, any spoilage which they take from the nation rightfully belongs to the Jewish people. So the Sfarno thus develops a very, very interesting way of dealing with this pasuk. When the Jewish people borrowed the gold and silver vessels from their Egyptian neighbors, the truth is they really had to return those. It was an act of borrowing. It was not an act of taking possession in the fullest sense of the term. And they had an obligation to return those vessels up until the point that the Egyptians drowned at Yam Suf. Once the Egyptians drowned at Yam Suf by virtue of the rules of war, the Jews were entitled to keep the spoils that belonged to the Egyptian soldiers, and they were also entitled to keep those gold and silver objects which they had borrowed, and up until that point had been obligated to return. But now, because of the rules of war, they were able to keep them for themselves, and they were morally justified in engaging in such an act. So again, it's a It's an interesting way of dealing with the issue which the Sfarno presents. One can argue, the Sfarno himself doesn't make this point, but one can apply the same logic or a similar kind of logic that the Sfarno applies over here to deal with another issue which is also dealt with by the Rishonim. When the Ribbono Shel Olam speaks to Moshe Rabbeinu in Perek Gimel, and he tells him, go to Paro and demand that the Jewish people leave, he doesn't say, tell Paro that the Jewish people, you know, should leave Mitzrayim for good. The specific request that Moshe Rabbeinu makes of Paro is let the Jews go for a 3-day Shabbaton in the desert. They'll worship me in the desert. And then the implication is, and then they'll go back to Mitzrayim. And indeed, if we look in Perek He, when Moshe and Aaron go and they stand before Paro, that's exactly the request that they make of Paro. Perek He, Pasuk Aleph. Ve'achar bo Moshe ve'Aaron ve'yomu el Paro. Moshe and Aaron came, they said to Paro, Kohen Hashem Elokei Yisrael, thus says God, the God of Israel, Shalach Esami, send forth my people, V'yachogu li Bamidbar. Let them make a holiday for me in the desert. And then later in Pasuk Gimel, V'yomu Elokei O'ivrim Nikra Aleinu. The God of the Jews came to us, and he said, Nelcho no derech shloshes yomim Bamidbar, V'nizbuchol Hashem Elokeinu. Let us go 3 days into the desert, and we'll offer up sacrifices to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So, here too, the Rishonim weighs the question. There seems to be something a little bit off with this request, which is the request that HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Moshe Rabbeinu to make of Paro. You're asking for a 3-day Shabbaton, but what you really want is really for the Jews to go free altogether. So isn't it a little bit less than honest to request a 3-day Shabbaton when really what you have in mind is something much greater? So using the same logic of the Sfarno, one might suggest the following. It's true that the original request was to go 3 days into the desert. But once the Egyptians waged war against the Jewish people, all bets were off. At that point, the Egyptians lost the war, and any moral obligation that Moshe might have had, the Jewish people might have had to say, you know, we only requested a three-day leave of absence, so now the 3 days are up, so now we have to go back, that requirement on any level to do that falls apart once the Egyptians engage in an act of aggression against the Jewish people. So in other words, that changes the calculus, perhaps. Once the Egyptians are aggressive against the Jewish people, you know, the original requests of the Jewish people are things that they don't necessarily have to abide with going forward. Okay. Take a look at another.
That kind of sidesteps it, because you said yourself that wasn't the intention.
Right, so
Well,
what we're suggesting, and again, you know, it's always a question of how history might have played out differently. Let's say that Moshe Rabbeinu would have said to Paro, we want to go for 3 days in the desert and offer up sacrifices to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And let's say Paro would have said, fine, I hear that, that's fine, you can do that. So at that point, you're right, Moshe Rabbeinu would have been obligated to come back when the 3 days were done. You know, but the original request, and Moshe Rabbeinu would have done that, had that indeed been what Paro would have said. However, Paro turned down the request, so Moshe Rabbeinu was not bound by the original terms once the Egyptians engaged in an act of war against the Jewish people. Now, not to make it overly political, but let's bring in just a modern day political example. I think it might be apt in this regard. Right, so one thinks about the partition plan in 1948, right? So the Jews agreed to the partition of Eretz Israel in 1948. The Arab nations, as we know, rejected the partition. And, you know, the war happened, and there were lines that were drawn, you know, after the War of Independence ended that basically set out what at that point then became the State of Israel. One hears in recent years the argument that, you know, we have to go back to the original lines that were drawn by the partition plan. So My understanding is, from the point of view of international law, that has no binding power whatsoever. In other words, the partition plan would only be binding on the state of Israel had both sides accepted it. Once the Arabs rejected the partition plan, so there's no moral or legal obligation for, you know, the Israeli side to accept what would have been the partition plan. In other words, you know, we made you an offer, you turned down the offer, so now that you're lost, you're coming back to us and you're holding us to the original offer. You're right, had you agreed back in 1948, so then we'd be bound, 1947, had you agreed back in 1947, we'd be bound by the terms of the partition plan, but you rejected it. So if you rejected it, don't come back to us later on and say that we're bound by it. I think that's a somewhat analogous way of looking at this negotiation, as you will, between Moshe Rabbeinu and Paro. Moshe Rabbeinu says, look, this is my offer on the table. We're going to leave for 3 days. Paro says no. So eventually, so there's an act of aggression against the Jewish people. He rejects the original offer. And finally, by the way, in Parshas Bo, when Paro lets the Jewish people go, he doesn't say anything about, you know, go for 3 days. He says you can just go. So now you're coming back with a taina. You know, you stayed out for more than 3 days. That was the original negotiation. We moved past that already. You know, you're right. In the original negotiations, we negotiated in good faith. That's what we wanted. Had you said yes, we would have accepted that. But the rules change once you change in terms of the act of aggression.
I understand that. That makes sense. But the original concept of one woman going to the neighbor, they made the agreement one person to one person. The fact that the king said, you know, before starting the war, that didn't break the obligation of the agreement between the neighbor to a neighbor, individual woman to another individual woman.
Right, so the point that Sforno is making is we do look at it from a national perspective, meaning it's not just about, you know, your obligation to an individual neighbor, but there is something called war between nations, and when a nation wins a war against another nation, they have the right to the spoils, not just the personal property of the soldiers, but the personal property of the population at large. And if that's the case, so, you know, in theory, you know, had the Jews invaded Mitzrayim and won, you know, they would have had the right to go into everybody's house and take their golden and silver vessels. So they have a similar right to be able to hold on to the golden and silver vessels which they borrowed because they won the war against the Egyptians. It was an act of aggression for the Egyptians to fight against the Jews. The Jews won the war, you know, the Egyptians were drowned. And, you know, that gives them the right not only to the personal property of the soldiers, but even to the property of the Egyptians as a whole. In other words, that's the nature of war, that one, you know, is able to access the wealth of the nation which has been conquered. So let's take a look a little bit further at the end of Perek Dalet. So Moshe Rabbeinu is convinced by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He goes down to Mitzrayim. And first of all, just a very, very short insight by the Sforno. HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells him, Pasuk Yutes, Vayomer Hashem Moshe b'Midyan, Lech Shuv Mitzrayim. Hashem says to Moshe in Midyan, now you can go back to Mitzrayim. Because all of the people who sought to kill you have died. Who are these people who sought to kill you, and how do we know that they've died? So we're probably familiar with Rashi here. Rashi quotes from Chazal that the Anoshim Hamavakshim Es Nafshecho, the people who are out to get you, the people out to kill you, are Dosan and Aviram, again the two individuals who were fighting, and basically were Malshin, they slandered Moshe Rabbeinu before the Egyptian government, and it's because of them that Moshe Rabbeinu had to flee. Dosan and Aviram are still alive, they're going to be making trouble for Moshe Rabbeinu throughout much of the rest of the Chumash. What do you mean, Mesu? What do you mean that they died? So Rashi brings that they lost their money, And ani choshev kemeis, a person who is impoverished, is considered as if he died. So basically the message, according to Rashi, that the Ribbono Shel Olam tells Moshe Rabbeinu is, I know Dasan and Aviram gave you a hard time, but they have lost their money, presumably because they lost their money, they also lost their influence. You know, they're not able to make trouble for you in the way in which they made trouble for you before. And therefore, it's safe, you can go back to Mitzrayim. The Sfarno has a much more sort of pshat orientation towards this question. He says, who are the anoshim hamevakshim es nafshecha? Who are the people who sought to kill you? Hamelech va'avodov asher bikshu lahargecha. It's the king, Paro, and his servants who previously sought to kill you. Kasher ber l'malo ba'amra v'yomas melech Mitzrayim. It already says earlier at the end of Perek Beis that the king of Egypt died. Again, Chazal understand that non-literally. Chazal understand that the king of Egypt became a mitzora, that he became a leper, and he, you know, had to be treated with blood. So many Jewish children were slaughtered in order to provide blood to treat the ailment of the Melech Mitzrayim of Paro. But the simple pshat is that the Paro in whose house Moshe was raised died, and it was that Paro who had put out the warrant, against Moshe Rabbeinu. After Moshe Rabbeinu killed the Egyptian taskmaster, so Paro had wanted to kill him. So the Ribbono Shel Olam tells Moshe Rabbeinu that Paro has died. Now it's interesting. The Sfarno also makes the following comment, which fits into this idea that it's Paro's death that enables the Ribbono Shel Olam to tell Moshe Rabbeinu, okay, it's now time to go back to Mitzrayim. Paro, who wanted to kill you, is not a threat anymore. Says the Sfarno, consider the two names of Moshe Rabbeinu's children. His first son is named Gershom, and his second son, who according to the Sfarno is going to be the source of a whole discussion that the Chumash is going to have, that we're going to talk about in a few moments, the son who almost didn't get a bris milah, but now is going to get a bris milah, his name is Eliezer. Why is Gershom called Gershom? So the Torah tells us, beginning of Parashas Yisrael, Ki ger ho'isi be'eretz nachriya. I was a stranger in a foreign land. I had to run away to Midian. Why is Eliezer called Eliezer? Ki elokei avi be'ezri. The God of my father was an assistance to me. And he saved me from the sword of Paro. It's interesting if you think about it, because on the surface the names seem to be in reverse chronological order. When did Hashem save Moshe from the sword of Paro? So Chazal say that that Moshe Rabbeinu was actually captured by Paro after he killed the Mitzri. Paro sought to kill Moshe Rabbeinu, and Moshe Rabbeinu was miraculously saved from execution, and then he ran away, went to Midian, and settled in Midian. So if that's the case, so you would think, chronologically, the older son should be Eliezer, the second son should be Gershom. Even if you don't work with that medrash, when was he saved from the sword of Paro? When he first fled Mitzrayim, right? You know, I was saved from Paro by virtue of fleeing from Mitzrayim. When did I settle in Midian? Only afterwards. So Eliezer should be the first son. Gershom should be the second son. I don't understand. Why is Gershom first and Eliezer second? So explains this one very, very simply. Al derech hapshat, like so many things that are, you know, you don't think about, but then when it's explained to you, you say, oh yeah, how come I never thought about that? Says this one very, very simply. Moshe Rabbeinu ran away to Midian and he settled there. So that was the first thing that happened in his life. Ger hoyisi be'eretz nachriya. I was a stranger in a foreign land. When was Moshe Rabbeinu saved from the sword of Paro? Only after Paro died. Because at that point, so the man who had put out a warrant for him was no longer among the living. So when did Vayatzileinu Mecherev Paro take place, says the Sfarno? Later, after Moshe Rabbeinu was already settled in Midian, and Paro had passed away. And now HaKadosh Baruch Hu can tell him, look, you know, Paro's no longer gunning for you. He no longer wants to kill you. He doesn't exist anymore. So now you can go back to Mitzrayim, you know, with a little bit of a lighter heart, and feel confident nothing bad is going to happen to you. So in other words, just on the Derech HaPshat, it makes sense that Gershom was so named before Eliezer, and it's Eliezer is only named after the news comes to Moshe Rabbeinu, Mesu kol ha'anoshim ha'mevakshim es nafshecha. The king is no longer alive, so you no longer have to worry about him doing anything to you when you come down to Mitzrayim. I just want to share briefly in the next moment or two. We'll make the moment last a little bit longer. Just want to share in the next moment or two, it's just a very, very beautiful svarno that he has at the end of Perek Dalet. So we know that the Torah in the end of Perek Dalet describes how Moshe Rabbeinu was on his way down to Mitzrayim. He stops off at an inn, and it says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu met up with him and wanted to kill him. And the only way that Moshe Rabbeinu could protect himself against being executed by the Ribbono Shel Olam is to arrange for the bris milah of this son, Eliezer, who had not been given a bris milah previously, and it's his wife, Tzipora, who steps up to the plate and gives the bris milah to Eliezer. It seems like it just comes out of left field. You know, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is now coming and looking to kill Moshe Rabbeinu for not giving a bris to his son. So listen to these words of the Svarno. Vayifgesheu Hashem, HaKadosh Baruch Hu met up with Moshe Rabbeinu. Perek Dalet, Pasuk Chav Dalet. Kara Yom Milas Beno. It was the eighth day after Eliezer was born, the day on which he should have received his bris. Asher bo tishra shchina la'amod bebris. On every eighth day of a Jewish boy's life, the shchina comes in anticipation of entering into the bris with the father of this child. A bris is not just about bagels. A bris means a covenant. So there need to be two sides to the covenant. One side to the covenant is the family who's making the bris. The other side to the covenant is the Ribbono Shel Olam himself. So the Ribbono Shel Olam himself, Kaviyachol, comes to every bris because he's a party to the covenant. So that's why Yifkisheu Hashem, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, came on the eighth day of Eliezer's birth, and he saw that Moshe Rabbeinu was doing nothing. Again, whatever Moshe Rabbeinu's svara was, and not giving a bris to Eliezer, but Lemaisa, he wasn't giving a bris to Eliezer. And for HaKadosh Baruch Hu to come and find that nothing is happening, you know, to bring the Shechina into a place unnecessarily, creates havoc, and that's what brought about the near death of Moshe Rabbeinu. Comments on this, the Svarno. V'ulai zos hisibas haminog lahachin kisei kavod b'mekom ha'milah. Maybe this fact that the Shechina comes every time there's a bris on the eighth day, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu Kaviyachol comes to every bris, maybe that's why we set aside a special chair at every bris milah. We usually refer to that chair as the Kisei Shel Eliyahu, the chair that's not occupied by anybody. It's for Eliyahu HaNavi. But the way the Sfarno understands, and he says this as well in Parshas Vayera, the chair is not for Eliyahu HaNavi, says the Sfarno. The chair is Kaviyachol for the Ribbono Shel Olam, who's the other party to the bris. A bris needs two sides. The other party to the bris is the Ribbono Shel Olam. He comes to every bris. And we want to set up a special chair for the Ribbono Shel Olam, Kaviyachol, at every bris. That's the chair that we have that's unoccupied every time we have a bris milah. Wish everybody a good Shabbos. Rabbi Chanan ben Akasha Omer. Ratzah HaKadosh Baruch Hu L'Zakos